Welcome to Frontline, the podcast talking about the issues affecting health, social and community workers in the UK. We're here to talk about the topics important to you and give insight on tackling the professional dilemmas which might be affecting you day to day. Hello and welcome to Frontline. My name is Chris Slater.
And I'm Dave Gill.
And welcome to today's show. But before we get cracking, Dave, how's things?
Yes, good, good. I'm excited for episode 3. I can't believe it's episode 3 already.
Blimey, where's the time gone? But I'm hoping that what we're saying is really resonating with people. And of course, if it is, please do get in touch, as always.
Absolutely, yes. We encourage your engagement. And in the next few episodes, we'll be really looking at what you guys have said and responding accordingly.
And it's interesting you should say engagement, because that leads us quite nicely on to today's topic, which is complex trauma. So, trauma. Now, that's a term I think practically everyone is familiar with. And I think certainly by today's standards, we use that term probably quite flippantly in some instances to describe, say, for example, a situation, oh, I was traumatized by this. But actually, it's a much more deeply resonating issue, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think one of the key things that we need to do is distinguish between what we mean by trauma and what we mean by complex trauma, because I think it's vital we do that.
Okay, so that's a really good place to start. So what is the difference between the two? So we have trauma on one hand, we have complex trauma on the other. Let's start with trauma. What are we talking about exactly?
One of the problems with defining trauma is people think about it in terms of the events. Would a car crash be traumatic? Would being assaulted be traumatic? Would, surviving an earthquake be traumatic? And the reality is that it could be or it couldn't be. Because what actually is traumatic is defined by your response to it.
From what you're saying, it's not the actual event itself, it's how the individual reacts to said event.
Yes, and the problem with this is we're not always prepared for our bodies and our mental health response to a traumatic event. Sometimes what we think will traumatise us doesn't, and what we expect to not traumatise us does. And that can be very confusing to a person. Again, if we think about a soldier who might be out in the field, seeing an explosion and seeing death and destruction might not traumatise that person. But then seeing someone who comes up to them in tears asking them about something might really traumatise that person. And sometimes the confusion can be, well, why has this resonated with me and the other thing hasn't? And there isn't always an easy answer to that.
You've actually beaten me to it there, because I also, funnily enough, was thinking about a soldier as an example, because, of course, essentially, they are trained to deal with trauma in a much different way to a standard individual, aren't they?
The problem with whatever trauma training we have, you still cannot plan fully for what's going to happen when it hits you, because the effect on it can be huge. Again, if we think about soldiers, and we go back to like World War One, we talked about it in terms of shell shock. Like, you know, something to just get over with, not understanding the true in-depth traumatic event that person's gone through. Because ultimately, what it is, you're defining it by your response, and anything that's leaving you feeling terrified, helpless, truly lacking in control. It is your most basic response as a human being to keep yourself safe. If anything has affected that, and the event has left you feeling helpless and terrified, you are going to be in a strange situation, and it can be incredibly difficult to challenge and work through.
Is that what we would now understand and describe as PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder?
So yes, so I mean, in terms of how we define it from an NHS point of view, we utilise the term PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, with the emphasis being on post, as in you can only define it after the event has happened, because that is when the impact starts to hit in terms of you reliving the event. And when we say we relive the event, we don't just think about it. You feel the same emotions. You feel terrified. So we are talking fully reliving the situation. It can affect you day to day. It can affect your sleep patterns. And we know what it's like when you don't get sleep. You feel terrible. So all these things can truly start to affect your day to day life. Everything about you can and will be affected by this.
That's essentially a snapshot of what trauma is, and indeed what post-traumatic stress disorder manifests itself as. But at what point do we start talking about complex trauma? What point do we move away from just a singular traumatic event or episode?
I think what you've just said then sums it up. When we talk about trauma, it's usually a singular event, but you can access help for it and support for it, because you can kind of think, well, I went through that, I can do something with it. When we are talking about complex trauma, we are talking about a long-term, truly invasive level of trauma that someone has experienced, usually throughout childhood, often variety of different traumas, a different experience, different abuse, neglect, that will happen repeatedly, and you usually do not have a secure base or a secure attachment with your parent or caregiver, which means you don't have that safety net, and you don't have someone around you to make you feel safe. So you have to figure out your own ways to keep you safe.
Okay, so there you mentioned long-term and invasive. So can it be the same event repeated a number of times, or can it be a cascade or a multitude of different, say, traumatic events that all come together?
It's about that kind of long-term exposure to the trauma, whether it is, as horrible as it sounds, sexual abuse, the same sexual abuse repeated every day, every year, whatever it may be. It's a horrible situation. It's a singular event. It's nowhere worse or better than other forms where you have some sexual, some physical, some neglect. We can talk about the events itself. It is more about your response to it. With trauma, it's about understanding your resilience and revisiting it and talking about being open about it. When we are talking about complex trauma, because it happens in childhood, because it's long term, that person hasn't had an opportunity to build up any resilience. They've not had an opportunity to make sense of the world. So because they don't know what's going on, they just accept it as normal and try and figure out the world based on that.
So we've established that complex trauma, the genesis of it essentially happens in childhood. At what point does it actually start? Is it at a certain age, or can it happen right from birth?
The reality of this is, unfortunately, from the moment a baby is born. A baby comes into this world and needs what we call a secure attachment with a parent or a caregiver. It's an important distinction we make about a caregiver, because not every child, unfortunately, is able to be with their parents. So if they have a caregiver, foster carer, grandparent, if they form a solid attachment with an adult that's close to them, that looks after them, that's really, really good. What we're talking about from birth, that attachment, if that is not formed, that child is really, really going to struggle.
Okay, so assuming that a child has experienced complex trauma for obviously many, many years, right into, say, teenage and early adult life, what does that do to them in the longer term? What's the impact of it?
Because that child hasn't been able to form a secure attachment with a parent or caregiver, the brain actually responds in a certain way. So think of your brain like a tree. It grows to the environment. If you plant a tree in the middle of a field, plenty of sunshine, plenty of water, it grows, it flourishes, it flowers, everything is brilliant. If you plant a tree by the side of a building that's in the shade, the tree has to adapt. That is the reality of complex trauma. Your brain responds to the environment. So as it grows, you don't have a parent or caregiver to make yourself feel safe, so you find safety in other ways. And if you haven't been able to bond positively with parents, family members, friends, school, you will find something else to bond with. So this is where vulnerabilities can open up, such as substance misuse problems, sexual exploitation, horrible relationships, gang culture, all that sort of thing can start to embed at this age.
Do you think this is a natural precursor to, say, addiction?
There was a study called Hard Edges that came out in 2015, so relatively recently, that identified that 85% of people accessing substance misuse, homelessness and mental health services have experienced trauma in childhood, which tells us that there is a strong correlation between drug use, mental health problems, not having a secure home, and the trauma you've experienced in childhood.
How long has this kind of concept been around? How long have we been thinking about trauma in a more complex sense?
Unfortunately, the UK is a little bit behind in all this. And if we look at the world leaders around trauma and trauma awareness, trauma-informed care, we have to look in America. And in particular, there was a specific study done in 1995 to 1997 called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. The point of the study was to try and figure out the experiences you have in childhood, if negative, how do they impact on you into adulthood? You were asked to report on a score between 0 and 10 of so-called adverse childhood experiences based on abuse, neglect and household dysfunction as they classed it. What they found was quite a few people had a score of 1 or more because they thought, you know what, it's just reality. What they were surprised at, out of the 17,500 people that took part in the study, they found that 12.5% had experienced 4 or more adverse childhood experiences. At this point, they realised that hitting that score of 4 or more actually started to have huge impacts on your physical health. So there's entire studies looking at people's physical health from having these adverse childhood experiences. Thankfully, in the late 90s, early noughties, we became a lot better at picturing and photographing the brain, and they realised that people's brain developed differently. If you've experienced this trauma, those adverse childhood experiences, your brain grows to respond to the environment. So in this case, if you've experienced trauma abuse, your brain doesn't need to develop complex thinking skills. It just needs to focus on being alive. Then this continues into adulthood.
So it's affecting the way our brains are hardwired, essentially. If that's the case, and given the fact that obviously the development is so very different, how can we identify that? How does that manifest itself?
We are more likely to see people, as we've said, who have experienced complex trauma accessing services because they haven't had that secure attachment. They usually struggle with school systems, which means they don't get education, they don't get the support, they don't have dreams, aspirations. So when it hits adulthood, usually there is something embedded in there in terms of drug problems, alcohol problems, mental health problems.
Fine. So just to cast the net a little bit wider and let's turn back the clock ever so slightly. We've already established that this kind of trauma is manifesting itself from a very, very early age. Is there not a way to pick up on this sooner?
A lot of local authorities have started to embed adverse childhood experiences into their safeguarding protocols in terms of schools are now being trained upon it to identify it. And if we identify it when that child is young, we can do preventative, positive work with the children. Again, it's not about going in and saying to parents, you're a terrible parent, you can't look after this child. It's helping that parent, helping that family environment and understand what we can do to help. Because the reality is, the people that are the parents have probably experienced this trauma before. And if we don't do anything with it, the likelihood is that this will continue. So rather than create a culture of blame and telling people they're bad parents, if we can go in and do some preventative work.
So steps have been taken to actually do that, but is it working?
Unfortunately, because there hasn't been a national approach, each local authority is tending to do their own approach at the minute. It's hard to really identify where the successes are. And because we've said with this whole experience that it takes time. So if you do preventative work now with young people, you're not going to really know the impact of this 5, 10, 15 years down the line, which then becomes the problem because people want to see outcomes. They want to see results. And this doesn't guarantee you outcomes or results for many, many years.
It's a bit like what we were discussing when we were talking about the psychologically informed environments. It's not a quick fix, is
it? Absolutely.
It's a grassroots. It's a long-term strategy, a long-term approach. How, as a frontline worker, will we start A, identifying that, and also B, starting to unpick it in terms of helping that person?
I think the first step is to realise that we can do something about it. It's very easy to go, oh my God, that there is no hope for that person. And I think that is a really false way of looking at this because the brain has something what we call plasticity, which means it can fire off and grow new neural pathways, new areas, and it can start to see things differently, which is good. Because I think at this point, if we thought there was no point, I think we'd all be packing our careers in and going, well, what's the point? So we can do something about it. And I think that has to be a really positive takeaway from today.
So the damage that's been done to somebody, are you saying that's reversible?
It will never be fully reversible because your experiences shape who you are. But in terms of how you grow and how your brain can grow and how you can accept some of the experiences you've gone through, you can develop and you can come out the other side into an element of recovery. I don't think we need to be naive enough to say what you experienced throughout childhood you can forget, but what we're saying is we can grow new neural pathways and develop and become a functioning, positive member of society, and that we can help you. Services can help people do that. We need to be thinking of the approaches we take.
Okay, so how would we go about trying to help someone with those kind of needs?
What we can do is utilise something called trauma-informed care. So using this knowledge to think, how can we respond effectively? And this is why it's a useful secondary subject to be covering after psychologically informed environments, because a big part of that concept is understanding the individual, putting the individual at the front from a strength-based, person-centred approach.
And in fact, we're going to be drilling down into that further in a future episode, aren't we?
Yeah, so when we talk about trauma-informed care, we're very much doing an introduction now, and it deserves its own podcast. So we're going to cover some key points now, but in future episodes, we will look in far more depth. I guess the first thing to think about around trauma-informed care, to sum it up, we need to be thinking around creating safe, positive, validating relationships. absolutely fundamental, because a big element of the abuse that people have experienced, the trauma that people have experienced, is lacking in that trust, lacking in that secure attachment with a parent or caregiver.
And again, that's actually a natural extension of what we were covering in the last episode about psychologically informed environments, making sure that they are welcoming, they are engaging, and that we can actually make the connection with the individual, with that service user. So is this just an extension of that?
Their brain has grown to respond to chaos. So they're always on the move, they're always keeping themselves safe. And then services turn around and say, well, you've got to be at your appointment 9 o'clock on a Monday morning. If you don't turn up for that appointment 9 o'clock Monday morning, you're out. The reality for that person is they might be in such element of chaos, they're not even thinking about it. They lose track of what day it is. And it suddenly gets to Tuesday afternoon and they go, oh my God, I missed the appointment. Not through choice, through absolute chaos. And then when they go to the service and say, I missed my appointment, we can very quickly wag our fingers and go, well, you should have turned up, because you missed your appointment, you're out on your ear now.
Okay, so what's a better way to approach that kind of behaviour?
We need to be thinking about the engagement. So when someone comes in, again, if we have a psychologically informed approach in our services, we automatically create a welcoming, positive environment. Ask, use it as a person-centred approach to ask that person, how do they engage? What's going to work for them? How can you make that person feel safe? Get them to tell you, rather than us dictating and saying, right, you've come to our service, you come to us because you've got a drug problem, fair enough, so I'm going to make you drug-free. We're not giving anyone a choice. What we need to be saying when someone comes through the door, thank you for coming, what do you want from us?
So really, we need to be asking, what exactly, as you just said, what do they need from us, rather than this is what we're going to do for you?
Yes. And I think sometimes it's the language we use as well. And knowing if someone is struggling, even something as simple as, you know what, my life is such chaos, I cannot do Monday morning appointments, it's just not going to work. And rather than us going, well, that's the only appointment available, you've got to do it, we should be more responsive and say, right, well, how about Tuesday afternoon you come in? Ideally, we would like to give you an appointment at, say, 3 o'clock, but we accept you might be running a little bit late. Think about how you can factor that in. It's not always easy to do, but if you can show an element of flexibility to begin with, you can build up that trust and that positivity.
So we've started that journey of trust. We've been giving the service user more flexibility. What's the next step after that?
It's about reinforcing those positive relationships. And to do that, one of the things that we almost need to take a step back here and think that this approach needs to be undertaken by everyone. And by everyone, I mean everyone. So everyone involved who works for your service needs to be aware of this, from your receptionist, your volunteers, your frontline manager, your frontline workers, your senior managers. Everyone needs to be aware of trauma to understand how we respond. Because you might have 10 members of staff who are absolutely brilliant, and that one member of staff who doesn't understand trauma, they can undo all the hard work that you've done. They can become very punitive. Well, you didn't turn up to your appointment. It's your choice. It's your fault. That can undo all that positive work that you've put in place. So not only do we need to create a safe environment, we need to make sure staff are all buying into this and singing from the same hymn sheet.
We're just removing a kind of blame culture.
Yeah.
And actually, that's, again, another example of a cultural shift, which is what the PIE process is all about, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think a recent example of this for me was I was supporting a service around implementing trauma-informed approaches. And what was brilliant is that they put on their training a member of staff who worked at the hostel, who's a buildings manager, who very rarely had direct contact with service users. However, he'd worked in this field for many, many years, and he was angry and frustrated because he was saying, every time I fix a room in this hostel, someone comes in, smashes it to bits, and it annoys me. However, by understanding what trauma was, what he actually was able to do is understand that he was designing rooms based on his views. So he was creating really clinical, cold environments. He wasn't asking for service users' views on how they should be painted, what should be included, and it was like a light switch moment for him. And he went back and implemented this, and he was in a position of, you know what, I'm going to get service users. I'm going to ask them if they want to help me paint it. I want them to feel like they are a part of this, as opposed to me deciding what these rooms should look like. So the service users feel more valued, and he gets better job satisfaction because he understands why people behave the way they did. It's not to say that he'll never have to rebuild a room again after someone has kicked off, but it will be reduced. And when it does happen, he will understand the why.
So how does this work from the perspective of a frontline worker who actually does need to directly engage and work with a service user who has got complex trauma?
If we have got the foundation's in place, so psychologically informed environment, so you've thought about the layout of your building, you've thought about the safety aspect, you've ensured all your services, all your workers are trained and aware of what trauma is, and like we say, that means everyone. If that is in play, as a frontline worker, you need to be there thinking about safe, validating, positive relationships that is built around strengths-based practice. By that we mean, when someone walks through the door, you have to be aware that this person might never have had any sort of positive relationship with an adult for maybe a long time, if ever. You might be that first person that has a truly positive relationship with that person, which means it might be very, very difficult because that person might never have had true trust before. They might never have had what we classify as well as intimacy. When we talk about intimacy, we often talk about it from a romantic point of view. But intimacy just means the ability to feel like you can truly open up and be honest with another human being. So from a professional point of view, everything we should be doing is around that safe, positive, validating relationships. Think about how you can avoid being punitive, how you can avoid saying you must do this, you must do that. Asking that person what they want to achieve. How can you do it together? As a professional, sometimes we have a power imbalance. You are the professional, you can fix me, I'm just the service user. And sometimes that service user has created that through years of what we classify as social disaffiliation. They have been cast out from society, so they don't believe there can be anyone else but a service user. The joy of this role is to try and balance that power out so you can create a collaborative approach.
I just want to sidestep a little bit there. Obviously, it sounds fantastic in theory, and of course, if you can shift that dynamic onto more of a level playing field, then that's fantastic from what you're saying. However, though, the timescales involved in that happening, because like we established earlier, this is not something that can just be unpicked in 5 minutes. This is obviously long-term psychological trauma that we're talking about. In terms of the time constrictions a lot of service providers are working under, how do the two work together?
Not well.
I thought as much. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, this unfortunately is one of the biggest challenges to a trauma-informed approach and implementing trauma-informed care, is that acceptance that someone comes in and we cannot be overly prescriptive of you need 6 sessions and then you are fixed. Because this person might take weeks, months, or I hate to say it, but potentially years to build up that trust. If they've had such a negative experience in their own past, or even, let's not forget about this, from when working with professionals in the past. If professionals have reinforced that they are just a service user and that they should be listening to what the workers are saying, that relationship can take years, months, weeks, whatever it may be, to build up, which goes against key performance indicators, outcomes, and how services are commissioned. So when we are talking about trauma-informed care, really, and thankfully this debate is happening, we need to be pushing it towards the commissioning side of things as well.
And again, devil's advocate time a little bit, but just say, for example, right, I'm a service provider. I'm the head of a service provider. This is a new approach that I want to take. Of course, my budget is quite restricted. Obviously, my KPIs are quite restricted, and the time for my frontline workers is obviously quite restricted as well, as we just said. How can I go about introducing this with those kind of narrow margins?
Whatever approach we take, we have to be utilizing something, because we keep using the same approaches every single year, and the same people are accessing services year in, year out, coming around and around and around, and they are not getting that long-term recovery they need. So whatever we do needs to be underpinned by accepting that this is an approach we have to take, because other approaches just aren't doing what we need them to do. If you are limited on your budget, for me, what you need to do is, first of all, create a pie environment. Really think about that positive environment that you can create. Then secondly, create an environment where everyone becomes trauma aware. That has to be point number two. Thirdly, you need to be thinking about what changes you can make right now. What sort of things can you do to ensure that that person who comes in through your building might have experienced trauma, might be struggling? What can you do to help that person? As we will see in future episodes, particularly around a trauma-informed care model, we need to be doing a lot around reducing re-traumatization. So putting that person in a position where they're experiencing those horrible situations again. We need to be creating an environment where we utilise a lot of here and now tools to stop people dwelling on the past and revisiting that trauma, such as self-soothing tools, mindfulness tools, really kind of bringing someone to the present. And we also need to be thinking about maybe the paperwork that we use, the questioning style that we use. Again, thinking about motivational interviewing, in terms of the questioning on the assessment forms, and particularly thinking about challenging our views on risk, because usually we wait for a crisis point to hit, such as someone gets angry, kicks off, we throw them out. We need to be challenging that word risk and shifting it around and thinking about safety. Rather than waiting to a crisis point, what can we do to help that person to ensure a crisis point is never or very rarely hit?
Realistically, we're not talking about reinventing the wheel here. We're talking about just thinking about what is at our disposal in a different way, which again we covered in the last episode.
That's the joy of this, is it's a culture change, it's an approach, which means that we can start to do things now. You can all go back into the office tomorrow and say, right, what can we do about this? What small changes can we make? And it's like cumulative gains, you know, bit by bit. If everyone makes slight little changes to their own individual practice, revisits their paperwork, revisits their questioning style, we will start to see improvements.
And in one way, it's a bit of a snowball effect, isn't it, on both sides? Because we've talked about complex trauma. It starts from a very early age, almost from birth in some cases, and it snowballs over time to become a very, very deeply ingrained problem, which is going to require a lot of hard work and a lot of effort to start undoing. But at the same time, in order to help that person, we're talking about a snowball effect of change. We're talking about looking at our value system, looking at processes, and just gradually introducing and thinking about things differently. And by doing so, we're actually snowballing in more of a positive way.
If we are in a position where we can do something, and I do mean anyone, whether you are volunteer, frontline worker, manager, you will find, if you embrace it and push it, people will get on board with you, because people want to see positive change. And the joy of doing this as well is, for you as a worker, it actually increases your job satisfaction. You start to see better outcomes and you truly start to see people changing for the better.
And indeed, if you are working for a service provider who has already implemented this kind of strategy, please do get in touch. We'd love to hear your experiences on this.
The more we share our ideas, the more we share what's worked, the better we will see the outcomes, the better we will see the approach. Because the thing with understanding complex trauma is it's not an off-the-shelf model. It isn't one size fits all. You need to look at your service, how you deliver it, the people you work with, look at the concepts and think about how you apply it. I can't walk into any service and start dictating to what you must do, because it's just not going to work. Someone can go in and give you the tools, give you the ideas, the concepts, but you as a service needs to take the ownership on it and implement it. And I think there's something truly empowering about that.
Absolutely. No one's here to dictate the answers. What we just need to do is ask the questions.
Absolutely.
Well, we're almost out of time today, but one thing I've really taken away is I've broadened my understanding of what trauma actually means. We mentioned right at the very start of the show that trauma, a lot of people associate it with an event, like an accident or a disaster of some kind, when actually it's not that, it's just our reaction to said event. And in fact, complex trauma can just be a cascade of that. It's not one singular pinpointing event in someone's life that makes them go down a road in which case they're going to be accessing services. It's a multitude of things, and it's just being able to understand that.
If we as a society get better at this, and I don't just mean in services but as a society, again, if you have a child, the whole system is designed around keeping that child alive in terms of physical health, in terms of feeding, changing nappies. If more effort was put in around how to engage with that child, how to love them, how to play with them, how to support them, I think we could start to see some real improvements as well. Complex trauma is understanding that people's experiences will have shaped them and do shape them. Your brain grows differently. Your understanding of relationships, your understanding of society grows different. Because of that, services have never been built to respond. They've been built on the professional's perspective. And sometimes looking through the lens of a trauma can help us understand what someone else has been through, and creating that safe, validating, positive relationships. And even, as horrible as it sounds, some people aren't comfortable with this, but reparenting people by creating that intimacy and that positivity will have a really positive impact on people's lives.
Now, time for Quick Shot. 5 questions, 5 answers in less than 30 seconds. Why is this important?
Because experiencing trauma can shape your entire worldview.
What are the key areas?
Complex trauma happens in childhood and shapes everything you do as an adult.
What can you do as a frontline worker?
Look beyond the behaviour. Why is someone acting the way they do? Am I helping this person feel safe?
What should you avoid?
Only responding to the behaviour. It's not going to help that person, and it will just frustrate you.
What will this mean for the future?
It will mean that services are truly responding to people's needs and be able to give them the service they deserve.
Can we just get a quick snapshot of our next show?
So on the next podcast, what we're going to do is a part two of this podcast. So this episode has very much been about complex trauma, and we've started to touch upon trauma-informed care. And next episode, we are going to go in more depth about what that actually looks like. A few little changes here and there can have a really positive effect.
And if you can't wait until then, don't forget to get in touch and tweet us. Details are coming up. In the meantime, I've been Chris Slater.
And I've been Dave Gill.
This is Frontline. We'll see you soon. Remember, this show is designed around you, so be sure to subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to join us as a guest on the next show, our email is frontline@risk-and-resilience.co.uk or follow us at frontlinepod.